Welcome to the ARHT Critical Care Curriculum. This is Module 3, Shock, and this is Chapter 2 of Module 3. My name is Andrew Fagan. You've heard me speak last before.
I'm Stefan Gabor.
And I'm Chris Duncan.
And today we're lucky enough to be joined by a panel of three experts in the field of blood. As you're aware, a large part of the shock module is related to trauma and bleeding, and so we're quite excited to have with us a number of guests. Why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Richard Charneywood from New Zealand Blood Service, transfusion medicine specialist.
Hi, my name is Chris Denny. I work as a senior medical officer in emergency medicine at the Auckland City Hospital and also serve as the medical director for Auckland HEMS.
And I'm James Lefevre. I'm an emergency physician at Auckland Adults Emergency Department, and I've been working as a HEMS doctor at Auckland for the last 3 years.
Quite the lineup there, Andrew. We've got a bunch of questions for them. Should we kick it off?
Absolutely. So we'd like to start off today's podcast by quickly reviewing some recent literature. And Chris Duncan has been kind enough to take us through the recently published PROPER trial.
Okay, so the PROPER trial. Primary outcome measures were penile prosthesis durability and patient satisfaction at 1 to 5 years post-treatment, and penile prosthesis...
Whoa. Are you sure you're talking about the PROPER trial?
Yeah, the prospective registry of outcome with penile prosthesis trial.
No. We're talking about the PROPER trial.
Oh, you mean the pragmatic randomized optimal platelet and plasma ratio trial?
Yes.
Don't use Wiki, friends. It's bad. Okay, so this was a trial looking at transfusion of plasma platelets and red blood cells in a 1-to-1-to-1 versus a 1-to-1-to-2 ratio in patients with severe trauma, essentially looking at mortality. So it was a pragmatic phase 3 multi-site RCT, and they managed to get 680 severely injured patients, all set in the North American setting, and the patients were collected between 2012 and 2013, so it's pretty recent. Patients were randomized to either getting 1-to-1-to-1 or 1-to-1-to-2, and there were 338 in the 1-to-1-to-1 group and 342 patients in the 1-to-1-to-2 group. All the other care the patients received was standardized to local standard of care interventions, and that's obviously uncontrolled. Their main outcome measures, primary outcome, were 24-hour and 30-day all-cause mortality. They had some secondary outcome measures that they looked at as well, which included time to hemostasis in theatre, blood product volumes transfused and any complications, and also the incidence of surgical procedures and, for patients that left hospital, their functional status.
So tell us about the results.
So for primary outcome, there was no significant difference detected for mortality at either 24 hours or 30 days. However, when you look at some of the secondary outcomes, there were some differences. Exsanguination, which was the predominant cause of death in all patients within the first 24 hours, was significantly decreased in the 1-to-1-to-1 group compared with the 1-to-1-to-2 group, and more patients in the 1-to-1-to-1 group achieved hemostasis. Amounts of red cells transfused was similar between the two groups.
So a very interesting piece of evidence that's getting a lot of publicity in the foam world. James, why don't you give us your take on the study results, how you feel it applies to what we're trying to accomplish with whole blood here at the Trust?
So the overall findings were they found a decrease in the rate of exsanguination within the first 24 hours, so in the 1-to-1-to-1 group compared to the 1-to-1-to-2 group. In the 30-day, although the 30 days, they found no significant difference in outcome. Overall, it certainly shows that the least favourable interpretation of the study would be that there's certainly a trend towards better outcomes for patients if you used a balanced transfusion approach with platelets, plasma and red blood cells.
So, Chris, I was wondering if you could comment on how the idea of a balanced transfusion would fit into the pre-hospital setting.
So I guess for a pre-hospital provider, the question is, can you generalize out a hospital where more austere environment, often multiple things trying to happen at the same time, minimizing scene interval, and obviously, aggressive attention to hemorrhage control? We believe the evidence coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan has shown that it is feasible to provide a pre-hospital blood transfusion. And what we were curious about is, you know, what's the civilian data? Where are the outcomes? Is this a benefit to the patients? And just a couple of weeks ago, a group out of Pittsburgh published in the Journal of the American College of Surgeons looking at pre-hospital center red blood cell transfusion, which was associated with improved early outcomes. And this is now 24-hour outcomes. But what they found was that up to 2 units of packed red cells was associated with an improved odds of survival, 6.31, confidence intervals being reasonably tight, sort of 1.88 to 21.14. But I think what we're seeing is that military experience overseas is now being reflected certainly in North American civilian practice. And we're quite keen to see how whole blood will fit in conjunction with tranexamic acid and, as we said, sort of early aggressive hemorrhage control. I think where we're excited in New Zealand is that this partnership with New Zealand Blood Service means we have access to whole blood. And one would think, you know, in an ideal world, you'd give some packed red cells. You would then go ahead and, you know, thaw your plasma and give some thawed plasma. You might even choose to bring some platelets along. But the logistical implications for an out-of-hospital provider to have multiple fluids to try to titrate whilst you're moving with pace through a scene is quite intimidating. And so to us, the most elegant solution is take a largely unfractionated collection of blood, which is both red cells and plasma, and try and, if you will, optimize a balanced resuscitation out of hospital.
Chris, I think you do have to be a little bit careful with the whole blood scenario of red cells and plasma. I think it is a philosophically potentially ideal product for this situation, but you do have to bear in mind that the clotting factors do degrade over time, and certainly by even 5 days old, the clotting factors have dropped to 80% of what they were. By 2 to 3 weeks, who knows whether you're transfusing anything much more than albumin and red cells. I think it would be nice to believe that that we're giving some clotting factors there, but as long as you're aware that the whole blood does age over time. One little concerning factor I saw in the proper trial, just to go back to what James was talking about, was that the 30-day mortality, though, wasn't different between the two groups. And I wondered what your thoughts were on how you were getting good survival initially, but that patients were still catching up, as it were, and dying by 30 days.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is, and again, we need to reflect, the proper study is an in-hospital study. And I think if you think about what could contribute to mortality in a multi-system sort of severe trauma patient, all of the sort of early interventions that take place within the hospital, and that includes operative interventions and other potentially pharmacologic interventions, need to be weighed up. And so to me, I don't know whether the power of the proper study will allow us to really get at that answer. I think one of the options is again to sort of start upstream and see whether, in fact, you know, in the future we look at a prospective comparison of whole blood versus packed red cells in the out-of-hospital setting. James?
So I agree with you, Chris. I think the study, I mean, the actual numbers there, we see a 12.7% mortality rate in the 1-to-1-to-1 group with a 17% mortality in the 1-to-1-to-2 group. With the confidence interval of -9.6 to 1.1. So although that means statistically there's no difference, you can always argue that there was a trend towards an improvement in mortality, and that if there were another study done of this type with a meta-analysis, you may find that, in fact, there is an important difference, because we're seeing a difference here of almost, well, it's 4.3%, which is pretty significant. And we'd love that for any kind of pill in terms of a difference in mortality.
So, gentlemen, I'd like to switch gears a little bit here. First of all, I'd like to commend all of you on your efforts, and I'm sure it was a massive undertaking to get whole blood on board our helicopter. James, you were the project lead for this, and I was wondering if you could take some time to comment on the process of establishing whole blood on our helicopter, how you went about achieving that.
So it's become logistically possible to give blood to someone outside of a hospital setting, largely through the unfortunate wars in the Middle East, good evidence has come out that we can carry blood safely. And I think that, that military evidence has really become quite solid, that it's clear that it's of benefit to patients in the military setting. And we're seeing some good data now in the civilian setting as well. And if only looking at the market model alone across the shores to our Australian colleagues, that the large, my understanding is most of, if not all the states, provide pre-hospital transfusions. So they've decided on the market model alone that that appears to be everybody is doing, and they feel that getting good patient outcomes as a result of that. And I think intuitively it seems obvious that it's better to give somebody red cells than cold diluted saline. So we decided that this was something that was worth doing and made a number of approaches, but the best approach, and we've got very good collaboration from our New Zealand Blood Service colleagues, and we've ended up with a collaboration between the Auckland District Health Board, Auckland Regional Helicopter Trust, and NZ Blood Services, which has been quite an achievement, really. So we're using a Credo cooler, which is also called the Golden Hour Box, and I believe it's also the solution that London Hems have used and that has been used by the British military. So we've gone, the New Zealand Blood Service has gone through a validation process, and we've found that with a 48-hour turnaround time that the box has been very solid at keeping blood between 2 to 6 degrees.
Just to amplify what James mentioned, we're fortunate that we exist as an, if you will, collaboration between a district health board, in our case the Auckland City Hospital, and the Auckland Rescue Helicopter Trust. So we both have the means to get to places that we can deliver blood, but we also have a good relationship with people that can provide it. And what's made a huge difference is the contribution of the New Zealand Blood Service. And through Richard Charlie Wood's leadership, what we have now is a setting which could be expanded, if necessary, to other parts of New Zealand. And it meant that there was a rigorous level of oversight at a national perspective, but it also meant that the validation of the coolers we use, the way our process has been set up, has all been done to simplify life for a clinician, so that it's really just tearing a security label off, following a checklist, and that the whole act of providing a pre-hospital transfusion we think is as safe as we can make it and as simple as we can make it.
Thanks, Chris. I'm not really sure what I can add to that, other than from the blood services perspective, what we wanted to do was firstly to make sure that the blood was safe for transfusion. So we needed the blood to retain its cold chain throughout its life. And that's where the Credo box is so useful, with its phase change material keeping the blood at 2 to 6 degrees. The other part that we were concerned about was making sure that the donor's gift was acknowledged and that blood wasn't wasted through inappropriate use or inappropriate storage. And I think we've been very successful on all counts in ensuring that. From a national perspective, our philosophy was, being a national organization, that if we can set this up for Auckland, we will use the same principles elsewhere, and essentially the technology and the systems that we have in place are easily transferable. The one thing that isn't so transferable at the moment is that Auckland Helicopter Rescue Trust is unique in New Zealand in having a medical team going out with the calls and with the blood. And the New Zealand blood policy at this stage is that only if there is a doctor on site would blood be transfusable.
So I was hoping to explore the trigger criteria for transfusing a unit of blood. Chris, can you maybe answer that? And maybe James might have something to add to it as well.
Our hypothesis was that if we were going to use this precious resource, we needed to be able to defend our decision-making in front of our peers. And so towards that, we looked around and said, well, what are people doing in the out-of-hospital setting today? A lot of services have a subjective trigger, so with an appropriate mechanism which would make a clinician suspicious for severe bleeding and hemorrhagic shock, that would be enough to trigger the initiation of a pre-hospital transfusion. I think it's also worth, in our standard operating procedure is available on the Auckland HEBS website, This needs to be considered in the setting of control of bleeding. And so I think it's really important both considerations made for the differential of shock, but also aggressive attempts at hemorrhage control are done for obvious reasons. In terms of our trigger, we sort of looked around at the evidence and said, well, no one's actually answered this question specific to our patient population. But there's some quite good prognostic tools, both for looking at the risk of a massive transfusion, but also the risk of acute traumatic coagulopathy. And so we set upon the ABC score, which in brief looks at characterizing tachycardia, so a heart rate greater than 120, hypotension, so blood pressure less than 90, penetrating mechanism, and or a positive ultrasound, so it's described as a positive FAST. And that, to us, was useful, and I should say that our trigger is you need two or more of those to initiate a transfusion. And the evidence from the ABC score would suggest that a score of two or higher would predict about a 50% requirement for a massive transfusion protocol. Some have said, well, is that too stringent? And I think the answer is we don't know. But the early performance of this tool would suggest that patients who meet this score go on to need blood very quickly upon hitting the door of our hospital. And so I think what we're trying to do is use criteria which we can measure out of hospital, which other providers would intuitively understand. So it's just a set of observations and then the use of point-of-care ultrasound. So we look forward to kind of looking into this during our prospective audit of the study.
So I have a couple of questions to spin off that, and I'll throw these over to you, James. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of the ABC score is that it was validated in a traumatic hemorrhage population, which in all reality is going to be the most likely reason that we use blood pre-hospitally. We were wondering about the use of blood for non-traumatic hemorrhage. And should we be using the same trigger criteria to administer the blood, or should that be more of a physician gestalt, or I should say a crew gestalt from the medical team?
So it's important to remember that the ABC score was, I wouldn't say that it's been validated, but it's been studied in really in the setting of trauma rather than in the other circumstances that we might use blood in. So we did think about those because it would be silly to be flying with blood and have a non-traumatic situation in which a person was exsanguinating and not use blood. So specific symptoms, specific situations that came to mind were the patient with severe gastrointestinal hemorrhage with shock or other medical problems such as the truly ruptured aortic aneurysm with shock, obstetric hemorrhage with shock, and also pediatric trauma for which we wouldn't really be able to use those same numbers because they kind of would be age-dependent physiology. So we've decided that, well, that the indications for giving blood pre-hospital would be if the person has a traumatic cardiac arrest, if they meet two or more out of the ABC score and both clinicians agree that it's the right thing to do, or if they have one of these non-traumatic or pediatric traumatic scenarios and that both clinicians agree. And the reason that we decided that we should have both clinicians sort of explicitly agree that it was the right thing to do was really because of a number of situations in which the ABC score may not, even though the person may meet that score, may not, transfusion in that situation may or may not be the right thing to do. So just to give you a couple of those sort of scenarios, so if you had, for instance, a 24-year-old person stabbed in the chest, conscious with a pulse of 130, a systolic of 110, fast positive, maybe warm and peripherally perfused. So that person gets a point for penetrating because it's a stab wound chest. They get a point for a pulse of 130 and they get a point for fast positive. Now, some people may think that that person should be transfused and some people may not. I guess it would depend on the transport time and a number of factors, but I think it's important that both clinicians would discuss that case. So another example, so let's say you have a 48-year-old female with blunt abdominal trauma, chest trauma, with a pulse of 110, fast negative, with a systolic blood pressure of 70 and a pelvic fracture. So that person gets 1 point on an ABC score, so we wouldn't transfuse them necessarily based on our criteria, but it's not entirely clear whether or not that person needs blood. So that's the kind of downside of an ABC score. And to take a non-traumatic situation, if you, for instance, had a 20-year-old female, postpartum hemorrhage, pulse of 110, GCS 14, peripherally cold, systolic of 50. So this person doesn't have a trauma. They only actually get 1 point on our ABC score with the systolic blood pressure, but that person, both them and their baby, clearly need to be transfused. So certainly I would be transfusing that person outside of the ABC score, and we can't really generalise the ABC score to that population.
So I guess it's really important then, if blood is being transfused, that the whole team are aware of this and the whole team are supportive of that decision, especially where the blood's being given where it's outside of the ABC score. And I guess that's embedded in ARHT's guidelines and SOP for giving blood, in that both the paramedic and the doctor have to agree that it's the right thing to do and beneficial for the patient.
Where did he come from?
So, Richard, I want to pose a question to you. What are the risks of transfusing a whole unit of blood at 4 degrees?
Thanks. I think it's important to realise that the unit itself is fundamentally safe. Now, the risks of HIV, hepatitis C that hit the headlines in the last 10, 20 years are now vanishingly remote. So HIV infection, risk of 1 in 7 million. Hepatitis C, 1 in 2 to 4 million. So remote risks, you're far more likely to win the lotto 2 weeks in a row. The real risks around transfusion are, in this setting, ensuring that the unit is intact, so there's no opportunity for bacterial contamination. And, of course, you have the risks of a cold product being infused into the patient. So that is an unfortunate consequence of having to store the unit at 4 degrees. Risks of hemolytic transfusion reactions are very small, given that the unit is O negative, so is ABO compatible with the patient. There is a very small chance that the patient would have some other red cell antibody, which the unit of blood would cause a reaction to. But published literature in this area suggests that that is, again, a very small risk, well less than 1%.
So, Chris, we've made great strides at the Trust, bringing blood on board as one of many treatment modalities, or a drop in the bucket, if you would mind the pun, with regards to our trauma patients. Can you outline where this fits in with the overall management of a severe multisystem trauma from pre-hospital right through to the operating theater?
Yeah, we acknowledge we're only part of the patient journey. And I think if we just pause and consider what happens if you have a cardiac arrest, I think we would look to cardiology and the EMS system as partners in that chain of survival. So from the time of a bystander recognizing and performing early bystander CPR, timely communication, effective tasking, early defibrillation, and obviously then, you know, sort of targeted temperature management right through to cath lab, there's a lot of impressive stuff, but all of those steps need to work together in almost the setting of a relay. And so in the setting of major trauma, we again would say, and the evidence would support, effective tasking utilization is crucial. It does no good for this blood to sit waiting. It needs to be used for the people who are bleeding to death on the side of the road. And then more than that, there needs to be the effective hemorrhage control we've described, coupled with early communication. And we're just in the process right now with our hospital working towards what's called a code crimson. Other people call it code red or a red blanket. But that concept that for these physiologically deranged, massively traumatized patients, that it's you need to pause your operating theater if there's not a dedicated theater. You need the operating team ready. You need blood bank ready. You need interventional radiology pause, whereby if they're required, they're required, and it's effortless transition. It's a seamless transition into hospital. And it takes a lot of people working together, but we're really pleased at the collaboration we've got right now with the city hospital and hoping to make that more of a regional program later this year.
So, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you from the whole education team for your involvement in today's podcast. Before we sign off, I was wondering if there's any final thoughts.
So I guess looking forward, both for our service, but I think nationally, we're quite keen to work with other organizations because our belief is that kind of damage control resuscitation starts early in the patient's journey. And I think if you look, there's now the HERT, which is a hemostasis registry based out of the United States. There is a new multi-center prospective trial coming out of Melbourne in terms of the PATCH trial and looking at the use of tranexamic acid in a pre-hospital setting. I think we're getting to the stage now where we can start to work in pre-hospital networks to answer some of these questions in a prospective fashion.
Well, gentlemen, I'd like to formally thank you from the education team and from all of our listeners out there for participating in today's discussion. It's been beneficial for me.
Yeah, definitely for me too.
Thank you. So for the educational team, I'm Andrew.
I'm Stefan.
Signing off.